are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From the author of First Degree Rage, The True Story of the Assassin, An Obsession and Murder, comes the ongoing and chilling true crime saga of Elsie Underwood, the obsessively jealous police officer from North Carolina. Underwood shocked an entire city with his reign of terror and the lies of his ex-fiancée Kay Wedden, a woman he refused to let go, her son Jason, whom he despised, and her mother Catherine Miller, who got in his way. In First Degree Rage, Underwood arrogantly evaded justice for his heinous crimes until Detective Paula May and her investigative team uncovered who he really was. Because of their efforts, he was convicted for first-degree kidnapping and murder of Victor Gunnarsson, Kay's new boyfriend. But what was Underwood also responsible for the brutal murder of Catherine Miller that occurred mere days after Gunnarsson's demise? Sentenced to life in prison plus 40 years, Underwood has no intention of staying in prison and vows not to stop until he exacts revenge on those he blames for his current predicament. His thirst for revenge will not be quenched until more blood is shed. Underwood rages on, plotting his next move, enlisting others to perform the evil deeds he imagines, wreaking havoc in the lives of Kay, Jason, Detective May, and others. He sends them all on an emotional roller coaster ride that never seems to end. Will they ever find peace? Will Catherine Miller's murderer ever be brought to justice? Will Underwood's reign of terror ever be stopped? The book that we're featuring this evening is Raging On, with my special guest, detective and author, Paula May. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Paula May.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on and joining us again. We last spoke to you in April 2020 when we spoke to you about your book, First Degree Rage, The True Story of the Assassin, Obsession, and Murder, again about Elsie Underwood. Tell us just a little bit before we get into this incredible story, Raging On, how this is a series or it's connected to the first book, and tell us the impetus for, the reason for this second book.
Well, we, with the conclusion of the investigation of the murder and kidnapping of Victor Gunnarsson, we were hopeful that we would continue to deal with Elsie Underwood after his trial. But unfortunately, that was not the case. And his reign of terror continued even after his conviction and his sentence. And I had such an overwhelming response to First Degree Rage at the readers really encouraged me to complete the story, to tell them more about Elsie Underwood, and they were really hopeful that Catherine Miller's murder would be avenged.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those that didn't get a chance to listen to First Degree Rage, and it is important, regardless of that interview or listening to that interview or reading that book, to understand Elsie Underwood and the crimes that he did perpetrate. So you take the reader in Raging On back to December 3rd, 1993. But just before that, you take us to Salisbury, North Carolina. A small place of population 32,000 people in the county seat and located at the southeast of your hometown of Boone. So just tell us a little bit about your background and where you were as a law enforcement person at that time, December 93.
Right. And at that time, I was a detective with the local sheriff's office which was in Watauga County, which is in the Appalachian Mountains in northwest North Carolina. So Watauga County was my law enforcement jurisdiction. And as a supervisor there in the investigative division, it was a Friday afternoon in a really bad winter storm when the body of an unidentified man, the nude body, was found under a blanket of snow just off of the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is a national scenic byway there in the mountains. And he had been murdered by being shot twice in the head. And it took us a few days to get him identified. And when we did learn his identity, we discovered that he had been living in Salisbury, which was Salisbury Police Department was where Elsie Underwood was employed as a police officer, having had a little over 19 years of law enforcement experience. I didn't know him personally at all, even though we were both in law enforcement, because Salisbury is a couple of hours away from where I lived and worked. There was some investigators in Salisbury, which is Rowan County, and they were investigating at the time we found Victor Gunnarsson's body. He had been reported missing down there, so they were looking into that, but also they were investigating the homicide of Kay Whedon's mother, Catherine Miller, and that was a 77-year-old lady, sweet little lady, still working full-time, had worked at the same place for like 40 years, active in her church and her community, had no enemies whatsoever, and was just very close with her only daughter, Kay, and Kay's son, Catherine Miller's grandson, Jason Whedon. And so that was really a whodunit for them. Someone had entered her home. The alarm system had been deactivated, so they believed that it was someone that she knew. She also was shot twice in the head, but inside her kitchen where she was preparing her meager little dinner of a little pan of beans on the stove, and she had apparently been reading the daily newspaper. And so they were in the midst of that investigation. We found Victor Gunnarsson's body. He had been reported missing just a few days after Catherine Miller was murdered, although he had actually been missing a few days before she was murdered. And so the common denominator in those two cases was Kay Whedon, because Kay had been had just started, in fact, a romantic relationship with Victor Gunnarsson. And, of course, then her mother was murdered.
Mm-hmm. And she contacted the police. I found it very strange that she could not put everything together, but it's easier, much easier in hindsight, isn't it? But she, after her mother's funeral, thought it was prudent to be able to contact the police and tell them a little bit of information that now police were easy, much easier. They could make some deductions from that. When that happened and you became involved, what was some of the information that you learned about this police officer of 19 years? What did you learn about Underwood?
Well, I met Kay fairly early on after we identified Victor Gunnarsson, just one thing I want to say in Kay's defense, she had only started meeting Victor a week or two prior, even though they had seen each other almost daily. But so for a day or two there, even though she and Victor had made plans, she didn't know him that well and thought maybe he just wasn't interested in pursuing a relationship with her, or maybe things were progressing too fast for him. And so about the time and she had wondered where he was and had tried to get in touch with him, even had gone by his apartment a couple of times with a friend, you know, just kind of scouting things out to see if he was around, and there was no sign of him there. But then her mother was brutally murdered, so that just put her whole life into a tailspin. And it was after her funeral when she realized she still had not heard from Victor. And then it dawned on her that perhaps something had happened to Victor, that he had not gone away voluntarily, or he was not just blowing her off, but maybe someone had done something to him as they had done to her mother. So when I contacted the officials in Salisbury, and we had Kay look at the jewelry that was found on our victim's body, which was a very distinctive watch and ring, she very quickly identified them because he was wearing those the last night that she spent with him, or the last evening before he went to his apartment. So from after she identified those things, then I spent, that first day I spent with her probably was 8 or more hours in an interview with her, and then many times thereafter. And that's where I first learned about L.C. Underwood as far as his personality and his behavior and their relationship, which was completely unacceptable. He was very, very controlling, jealous, and his behavior was just way off the norm as far as trying to manipulate and control her. And then, of course, there were moments of violence. And as I began to look into Underwood's background, which became very extensive, that's a very extensive part of the investigation, we traced his background all the way back to his childhood and his infancy, where he was abandoned by both of his parents. He was left with an abusive uncle. And when the uncle got through with him, he grew up in a children's home in an orphanage in North Carolina. And then the day he turned 18, he left. And his relationships all during that time were dysfunctional. But when he became an adult and found himself in adult relationships with women that he either dated or married, his behavior was just extremely violent. And it was shocking to me that he was able to survive a career in law enforcement. But looking back and at that particular time, there was very little documentation in his personnel files about his behavior. But he would get in trouble with women, either stalking them, harassing them, and sometimes there were instances of violence. And before things got too heated, he would just go to another department. And so that was frustrating as a law enforcement officer to not find documentation of things that we were being told had happened. And people were well aware of the things that he had done, and there was physical evidence in those cases as well. And, like, at least one woman was hospitalized with severe injuries. Others were, their property was vandalized, and physical evidence was found in his possession of those vandalisms, like cans of red spray paint, for instance. And so he was able to survive all of that time. But he had been at Salisbury for police department for 8 years, and he finally had gotten suspended for his stalking behavior of Kay and some conduct that was, he just humiliated her in a restaurant where she was having dinner with a male friend, and that got him suspended. So there's a long history there, and that is kind of where I got into the story there, just with his relationship with Kay Whedon.
Mm-hmm. Now, he has this this relationship with Kay Whedon, and you mentioned stalking, which is the feature that it characterizes his behavior. And she had stalked, he had stalked Kay and Gunnarsson and her mother at this restaurant, and then had called her afterwards, which I just thought would the alarm bells would go off, that he knew the details. He had been stalking her that night and asked if her mother like the new boyfriend. So she knew his behavior in that regard, and then that was one of the reasons why she split up with him in the first place.
Right.
We have to fast forward a little bit because you gather evidence, and you talk about divine intervention in this regard too, with some of this physical evidence that came together, and it's fascinating. But the thing is that they were never able to convict him, let alone charge him, for the murder of Catherine Miller. And you explain in the book why that is. Tell us why, despite being able to have enough evidence to convict for the Gunnarsson murder, why there was not enough evidence, according to the DA, to convict for Catherine's murder.
Well, first of all, the district attorneys for each county, there were two different people, the prosecutors. The potential prosecutor for Catherine Miller was in Rowan County. And our case had the physical evidence as far as the mitochondrial DNA analysis, which was evidence that was confirmed to be Victor Gunnarsson's head hair in the trunk of Elsie Underwood's personal vehicle. And there were some other physical pieces of evidence as well. The only physical evidence in Catherine Miller's case that was able to be tied to Underwood personally was the fact that he owned a .38 caliber handgun, and that was the same make and model of the one that fired the fatal round into Catherine Miller. And then after both of the homicides, then both of the weapons that we know he had and likely used in homicides disappeared, and he refused to produce them. Mm-hmm. So they did not have the ballistic evidence that would tie the shooting of Catherine Miller to Elsie Underwood. There was a lot of circumstantial evidence, but we felt very strongly that a jury would convict based on the extensive circumstantial evidence. And there was some pretty significant circumstantial evidence, like multiple citizens saw vehicle matching Underwood's description at her residence at the time of her murder. They cannot positively identify it as he is, like they didn't have a license plate and that kind of information. But there was a lot of circumstantial information. But at the jury in our case, jury members told us that they would definitely have convicted him of Catherine Miller's murder, you know, had they been charged with making that determination. Mm-hmm. However, they weren't allowed to do that. And so initially, upon Underwood's conviction of first-degree murder and first-degree kidnapping of Victor Gunnarsson, the district attorney, everybody was, you know, pretty gung-ho about it. Everybody was optimistic that, you know, we just need to go ahead and give some justice in terms of our mother's murder. And but then after some lengthy discussions and looking at some of the 404B evidence, that's evidence of another murder that brought into Victor Gunnarsson's murder, said the evidence in Catherine Miller's case was brought into ours. The district attorney in Rowan County felt that, and of course, you know, with double jeopardy and so forth, you've only got one shot. We only had one shot at Victor Gunnarsson. They only got one shot at Catherine Miller's murder. So he felt like that if he tried the case at that point without the physical evidence that we had, that either the jury may find him not guilty. I mean, all they had to do was, you know, agree that there was a reasonable doubt. And that alone might give him an appeal that would grant him a new trial in our case, overturn our conviction, or that if they convicted him of murdering Catherine Miller and then he appealed something in that trial and something did not go well, and then our conviction could be overturned. So they preferred wait and hopefully find any additional evidence in the future, or if it looked like he was going to win an appeal in our case, then he would have that one holding over his head and they could then charge him. So I understand the strategy, but this strategy didn't help Kay Whedon feel like, you know, her mother's murderer had ever been brought to justice. So that was very painful for Kay and for Jason. And it was frustrating, you know, for me to know that he had killed this absolutely innocent lady and was never going to be charged with it. But I also understood, you know, we definitely don't want him out of prison. And if he wins an appeal and gets out of prison or gets a new trial, there's no guarantee of what might happen. And, you know, everybody was safer with him in custody. So that's how that happened. And we didn't feel like that we would have any additional evidence to find unless somehow the guns turned up, because we had investigated the case for almost 4 years. The four of us, our investigative team together with Salisbury and us. So we were optimistic that new evidence would be found, but at the same time, we didn't want to risk losing our case either.
Now, you talk about the practical terms of a life sentence plus 40 years, and you make sure that we understand it's consecutive sentencing, not concurrent. So 20 plus 40, but in real time, what does that really turn out to be? And then once he's behind bars, like you say, Kay doesn't feel safe, but neither do you. And there's a reason for that. Okay. So tell us why you don't feel so safe, what happens, but also how many years in practical terms before he may be eligible for parole. What does this sentence really mean?
So at that particular time, the sentencing laws were such that a life sentence equated to about 20 years, but that did not allow for things like earned good time and credit for different things that he could earn. And in fact, he had gone before parole board before 20 years was up. And so that 40 years on top was designed to help the life sentence actually be a physical life sentence. And that was a sentence that was imposed by the judge. The jury only made the decision for life or death, and they were 11-1 in favor of the death penalty. But
Well, we were talking about that sentence, and your response was a little garbled, but you talked about the practical, the 20 years that it would be, but he'd already had a parole hearing in that 20 years, so there was still fear every time that possibility happened, and there was so many other programs where he could get good time off, so that there really was a palatable fear that he may be released. But let's talk about how you became, just along with Kay, fearful for your life.
Certainly. I had, in the beginning when the investigation was going on and shortly after his arrest, he apparently fixated on me as far as I was the only female on the investigative team. I was the lead detective in the Gunnarsson case, which was what he was being charged with, even though he knew he was the subject of the investigation in the Catherine Miller murder. So I think that he thought his best bet as far as trying to gain sympathy or manipulate someone in the case was to choose me. And so at first, he would not have anything to do with anybody else in the case. If he spoke to anybody at all, it was only me. And we did not expect that he would ever even agree to an interview. And he really did not. But one Saturday night, shortly after his arrest, he had the jailer contact me and said he wanted to talk, but he would only talk to me. So I went to the jail, and he and I sat in the room alone with each other in the jail. And we talked. Made an effort at that time to try to extract from me what evidence there was against him. He was trying to interview me or interrogate me instead of the other way around, which I was not a surprise coming from somebody else, you know, that had been in law enforcement for so many years. And when that did not go his way, he became unfriendly with me and in fact, in that particular meeting is where I got a taste firsthand of just how his demeanor changed and a tiny bit of the rage that he held inside. And that's when his eyes went dark. And there was a very real presence of evil there that was manifested at that time in my presence. And so After that, we had a bond hearing. He was given no bond upon his arrest, but his court-appointed attorneys very quickly filed a motion for a bond reduction or setting of a bond. And at that particular hearing, I testified that I did not think that he should be released because I thought he was a danger to be released after he realized that he was going to be charged with that murder and that he was a danger to these other women and their relationships, and that they had given us interviews, which he was now entitled to discovery and so forth. And he all of a sudden hated me so bad at that point. As we took him back to the jail cell from the courthouse, he called me everything but a milk cow in the jail, and just enraged. He was so angry. And while he was serving, or while he was awaiting trial in the jail, he drew pictures of me. He just made horrible statements about me to other people, and it was very obvious that I'd become the center of his attention, you know, for that period of time. That did not go away. I think during the trial, he focused on another FBI agent, Don Gale, and the prosecutor, Tom Reischer, and me. So he was not only he did not only have the evil directed towards Kay Whedon, but he had focused on us as well. But me in particular, as I found out later, while he was in prison, he plotted and planned to kill me, and along with my husband and my daughter, who was a toddler at the time, in our house one night. And he had enlisted another person who was about to get out of prison and paid that person money. I was in the process of paying that person money, as well as who we believe also was the prosecutor, was another target of his as well. So I've now been in law enforcement more than 32 years, and many times, you know, we've received threats and, you know, so forth, but for lack of time, I won't go into all the details, but in this particular instance with Elsie Underwood, I mean, he had gone to great lengths to make it happen. And so I was fearful of him, and I did have to deal with that. Now, you have to go on with your life, but that cloud of fear never really goes away. And so at any given point, he could have escaped from prison. And I was well aware, people do that all the time. You know, that certainly was not beyond the realm of possibility. So, you know, that was what was different in this particular case for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity, Paula, to stop for a second to hear about our sponsor, which is ZocDoc. Just like many of you, I avoided going to the doctor during the pandemic. I skipped my physical and my dental cleaning and didn't see the eye doctor. But now that everything is opening up, it's time to catch up on our regular health care. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor, and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Whether you need a primary care physician, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, ZocDoc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, and I'm one of them. It's my go-to whenever I need to see a doctor. ZocDoc is great. You should try it. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/truemurder. Now, Paula, we were talking about this threat that was a real threat from Elsie Underwood from behind the bars of prison, but at the same time, you're always open to the idea of evidence, and a strange thing happens when Elsie Underwood contacts authorities to complain about a woman he met in prison named Lisa Collins. Tell us about this complaint and what it leads to and what you're curious about once you hear this complaint from Elsie Underwood about this woman.
Well, I have to tell you that it was pretty bizarre receiving a letter and a complaint from Underwood asking me to investigate a case where he was the alleged victim of a financial fraud. And so what he was requesting, though, was that we look into, he had given this girl, and incidentally, he had met Lisa while he was awaiting trial in jail in Watauga County. And he had given her access to his credit cards, and because she was his girlfriend from afar. And as it turned out, she took him for a ride, apparently, and maxed out the credit cards and so forth with her own expenses. But he wanted her prosecuted. And but the crimes had not occurred in our jurisdiction, so it was not appropriate for me to be investigating that particular those particular charges anyway. And I referred him to the appropriate agency, but for investigation. But that is how we learned about Lisa and their relationship. And even though the relationship ended temporarily, I guess because of the fraud, the defrauding of one another, their relationship, unbeknownst to us, continued because they remained in contact over the years, that even while he was in prison.
But what does she say, which piques your interest once you get to speak to her, once your part of your team gets to speak to her?
Yes.
Do you want to get some tangible details, something worth something? And what
Absolutely.
Does this woman, what does woman have to say that she learned in a prison, and how she learned this information?
Well, it was very interesting. Terry Agner and Don Gale, the Salisbury authorities that had located her, and actually they had attempted to locate her and was unsuccessful at doing that. And then she reached out to them after she had refused to talk with them. I think it was during a period, most likely when she and Elsie Underwood were arguing or estranged for a period of time. But anyway, when they ultimately got to talk to her, what she told them was pretty amazing, because during all of the years of the investigation, which was almost 4 years, and throughout, you know, waiting for the trial and so forth, Elsie had not admitted to anyone that he had kidnapped or murdered Victor Gunnarsson or had anything to do with Captain Miller's murder. And what Lisa told them was that as she and Elsie had gotten romantically involved in the jail in Watauga County by their cells being directly across from each other, he ultimately confessed to her. He told her that, and in sort of a bragging way, that he had kidnapped and murdered Victor Gunnarsson and that he had also killed Kay's mother. Lisa, her credibility was really suffering, but she did share with us some of the information that had not been publicized that she would ever had to have gotten from someone who knew about the details of the murder. And so she was able to tell us things that we already knew but that were not public knowledge. So that gave her some credibility. Now, so the investigators there talk with their district attorney, and he had some serious concerns about Lisa being able to testify to those things and her credibility. And even before he would have a chance to make a decision, Lisa would be gone and be out of communication and was uncooperative again. So she was she was unreliable as well as uncooperative at times. And so the district attorney felt like that's just not enough. You know, anybody can claim that she read this stuff in the newspaper or heard about it somewhere and is making it up to help herself out of trouble, because she was in trouble in and out of prison. And she had a history of not violent crimes, but she had a history of drug abuse and also a long string of frauds that she had committed against people, financial frauds.
Mm-hmm. There was also this idea that she asked where those weapons were disposed of, and that's pretty crucial to a trial, isn't it, the murder weapons. So what did he say to her, and then what was your investigative team's response to that location, supposedly, of those guns?
Well, just in a nutshell, she led the investigators on a wild goose chase. She had actually two or three stories about where he told her the weapons were, and also that she had physically seen them, and she probably did physically see them. Whether she disposed of them or disposed of them for him or actually had done anything with the weapons at all, that we may never know the answer to that, at least not the truthful answer. She's given more than a couple of different stories about where the weapons are. But she drew a map of where she had last seen the weapons, and they were buried in the state of Ohio. Investigators went to Ohio but were unable to locate the weapon. So there was an issue of her credibility. So the district attorney had a good point about that. But we also knew that she, and she alone, still being in contact with LC, and in a relationship such as that, LC planned to marry her as soon as he won an appeal or was otherwise able to get out of prison. And that was what he planned all along. And that's what she had agreed to. Now, whether she really meant that or not, you know, that was between them and him and her, but she had him convinced that she meant it. So we did, at one point, she agreed to wear a recorder, and there was a number of phone conversations that were recorded, but he would not talk about the murders over the phone. He said he would only talk about those in person. And so she agreed to go and visit him and wear a recording device. And she was able to talk with him.
Now, in this, because you get a copy of this, you are interested in this, you want to hear this, and now, for the reader and for yourself, and later for Kay, but you get some details from this. And to her credit, she very well acts like an informant in terms of almost like she was already very, very coached and very, very prepared to betray this person to gather this information. She said, because it's just not right that he killed this old lady, but she still had a thing for him, and that made her unreliable. But in this, to her credit, she does an admirable job betraying him and getting details of Catherine Miller's murder and Victor Gunnarsson's murder as well.
She did an amazing job. Lisa is very intelligent. And I think she was the one woman that LC in his personal relationships could not control. And that probably appealed to him on some level. But Lisa had been in and out of the system herself, and she was pretty tough. She's a pretty tough cookie. But, yeah, she did a great job of extracting information from him and getting him to talk. And when she got him started talking, he was very detailed. And she said, and her argument was, I can't, you know, I don't mind so much about Victor Gunnarsson, but there's no excuse for you killing this little lady that had never bothered anyone. And she said it, so in order for me to get, you know, to get past that, I have so many questions in my head. I need you to just tell me everything about what happened, you know, and let's put it behind us. And that was a tactic she used to get him to talk. And did she ever? He gave her information and indirectly us of how of each step he took and how he actually carried out each of the cases, the kidnapping and murder of Victor Gunnarsson and the brutal murder of Catherine Miller as well. Mm-hmm. So at that point, we think we got great evidence. I listened to the recording. I had heard bits and pieces of it over the phone. It was distorted and hard to hear, but when I listened to the tape itself, I did not have any trouble understanding what he was saying. And so that's the point that I was really super disappointed with the prosecutors in Salisbury, because I felt like finally there was a confession. It was obtained lawfully, and it was his own words telling exactly what he did, and not only the words and the physical things that he did, but also the total lack of remorse in his voice was very apparent.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about this clear, at least to you, was a clear confession of Catherine Miller's murder and why. And again, to her credit, she challenged him when he first gave a story. Was something she said, "Nah, that doesn't even make sense. Tell me the real reason." And so she really did push him to get that kind of information. Some of the details too, that again, this is for the reader to read some of these details of what Underwood said to Gunnarsson. Again, this full humiliation, asked him personal questions about the relationship with Kay. He said, even asked him if he had slept with him, where he had slept him, if he liked the mother. All of these details come out just to highlight his psychopathic mind on full display here. Now, with those details you said that are very clear on that tape, despite it having audio problems, again, why does the prosecutor decline to use that evidence?
I don't know that I can give you a really sound reason. He makes compelling arguments about his decision, and it comes down to it's his discretion and his decision. But and he's an honorable man. I don't want to imply that Mr. Kennerly is not, but and the investigators are quick to jump to his defense as well. You know, they say he's not afraid to try a case. He has a very solid history of successful prosecution, but he still was, he didn't feel like that the jury would be able to hear the tape clearly. He felt like that Lisa, that the defense would just tear her to shreds and maybe even get the whole entire thing thrown out, in which case we would be back at square one. So he was trying to be cautious, but I just personally I was disappointed that was not satisfying him. Kay eventually heard the confession, and I think that brought her some degree of, I guess, peace in some way, or some kind of satisfaction that she finally got to hear out of his own mouth, you know, that he admitted to killing her mother. Because, you know, no one's ever charged, even though everybody's confident about what happened. You know, she didn't ever really know 100% for certain, but once she heard it come out of his mouth, there was no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, and
so
he had said, He had said originally to Kay too that when he was whining, once he realized that she was with another man at the restaurant with the mother, that she said, he said, "Oh, your mother never liked me. She hated me." And despite Kay saying, "No, she never hated anybody," we never really get the details of exactly what he said to this woman before he murdered her. But there was absolutely no good reason whatsoever to go to her home for any reason except to kill the 77-year-old sweet woman.
Right, that's correct. There's no logic behind anything that he did, but certainly not concerning Catherine Miller.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of the readers can relate to maybe some extreme jealousy and that kind of thing, but you have to understand Elsie's background and the fact that he had severe issues, abandonment issues from not having his mother, and he resented even the fact that Kay even had a loving mother, much less the fact that she was trying to say, "Kay, this is not a good relationship. You need to get away from this man." I mean, Catherine Miller was very astute, very wise, and was trying to give her daughter good advice, but unfortunately, Elsie Underwood was aware of that and infuriated him.
Yeah, it's incredible, too, the effect on, as you write, too, because later you're interviewed and part of your team is interviewed as well, and this is called Dead of Winter. I'm getting ahead of myself, but at least the effect on yourself, your family, your husband, your daughter, everybody, Kay's family, her son, and rather than just, you know, the effect that this case had on you for a number of years. And part of the information that Lisa was able to provide too was confirmation that Elsie Underwood was the person that shot at the bedroom at Jason.
Yes.
And luckily, you say that luckily they just moved, rearranged the furniture, otherwise he might have been shot right in the head, or likely would have been shot in the head.
That very day, yes.
And Jason always, yeah, absolutely. And Jason, too, really had a lot of animosity for his mother because she brought this person into their lives and into being the person that killed his grandmother. So what you do write about is that one good part of this, and we'll talk about that in a minute, is that reconciliation over time in this story between Jason and his mother. So back to this prosecution that isn't going to happen, how does Kay feel about that? Does it end there in terms of her desire to have him prosecuted for her mother's murder?
Kay was in shock, frankly, because the prosecutor actually attended the same church as her mother and knew her mother. And all of a sudden, he's not speaking with Kay. She found out through a letter. Now, it's typical for there to be an official letter, from a prosecutor, stating whether he will or will not prosecute a case and explanations why if he doesn't. But Kay was really personally offended, I think, because he had not reached out to her directly. He had not called her or asked her to come by. She just finds out through a letter in the mail. And that the case is, he's not going to prosecute Kay. And Kay has had a fairly unhappy and fearful adult life. And it's sad, it's tragic, not just because of Victor Gunnarsson and her mother, but because of her estranged relationship, or at least her strained relationship with her son, who I think for many years on some level blamed Kay for bringing Elsie Underwood into their lives. And of course you can understand that to some degree as well. But until we were contacted by the Investigation Discovery and the producers of the TV show Dead of Winter, until we were contacted by them asking us, me and Kay and Kay's son Jason, to appear on the show and consent to an interview to discuss the case. That is the point that Kay and Jason actually sit down with one another and talk about what happened. Of course, Jason has grown up, you know, since then and was married. And so that was the beginning of the reconciliation between he and his mother. And so all of those years before that, you know, I just really hurt for Kay and for Jason, too. This Elsie Underwood took so much more from them than just those two individuals.
What you learn, though, is something, and what you impart to them as well, is that in those details from Lisa Collins, is that she asked them about going back to Catherine Miller's home. What did he go back to Catherine Miller's home to do? What was his intention?
When he went back to make it look like a robbery. And, of course, he didn't do a very good job of it. Pulled some drawers out of the bedroom and dumped those on the floor, knocked some magazines off of the coffee table in the living room and that kind of thing. But there were guns in the house. There was jewelry in the house. There was money in the house. That wasn't touched. I mean, it was clearly not a robbery. But he had gone back, I believe he told Lisa, about half an hour after he killed Catherine and fled initially, he went back. And it was at one of those times that other people saw his car there in the vicinity of Catherine Miller's home. But he went back to make it appear to be a robbery. And Lisa specifically asked him, did you check Catherine? Did you check her to see if she was breathing, if she had a pulse, and he did not. In fact, he avoided looking at her. And he said he knew when he shot her in the head, that she was dead. But, you know, Lisa's, she told us, you know, that she had asked him even before, you know, could you not at least have called 911 anonymously and have them go and just, you know, but, of course, he had no conscience about that, so he did not do that. And so there were details like that we learned because of Lisa and her efforts. Now, I will say that since that time, Lisa has overcome a lot of problems that she had in her life, like the drug abuse and so forth, and I'm still in touch with Lisa to some degree, and she is trying to improve her life and have a better life. She's no longer in North Carolina. And I only wish her the best. I only wish her success with that. And I do appreciate what she did for us.
Is Kay appreciative of what Lisa did as well? And even though there was no conviction for her mother's murder, does she feel better knowing more information rather than less?
She does, in the sense that it confirms what she had thought and what we had told her all along. It gives her more of a sense of closure, I guess. Just knowing, just being able to hear from his own voice what he did. Since she, you know, has not gotten any justice from the criminal justice system. And she understands to some degree the arguments. Well, she does understand the arguments about not prosecuting Underwood for her mother's murder, but it still doesn't satisfy her, you know, and probably it never would, and it never would for anyone. And even if he were prosecuted, even if he were convicted for her mother's murder, you know, it's never enough. It's never enough because, you know, the loss is so great.
Mm-hmm. You talked about your own retirement, thinking about retiring in 2018, and that came true in 2019 in January. But your last 10 years, you were chief of police in King, North Carolina.
Yes.
So what happens on Christmas Day 2018? Who do you get a call from?
Well, I don't know if I should have a spoiler alert, before we talk about this, or if I shouldn't say something did happen that did bring me some relief and some comfort.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay, all right. I can tell you that even though I all throughout my law enforcement career, and even now I'm still sworn to keep my certification, but I have retired from full-time service. But there wasn't hardly any time, any days or weeks that gone by that something did not make me think of Underwood and wonder and worry about what might happen if he got his way.
We didn't really go into this palpable fear that you had and your husband, Randy, who was a probation officer, I believe, and just the fear for your family, because as you, and again, we didn't go into too much, but it is a central part of this real fear that you had, because he did hire somebody to check you out, and you afterwards, with this fear, you also had this apprehension. So things happened where you grab a shotgun in your own home, and you say off duty you were carrying a gun as well. So this is not you're not exaggerating when you're saying that this really for many years was a fear that you experienced almost daily.
That's right. I could not allow it to be a crippling fear, but it was a fear that was always present. You can never get away from it, no matter where you are, because he or his representative could always show up, and that was just a very real possibility.
Mm-hmm, certainly. With this book, the first book, First Degree Rage, that was released last year, this book, Raging On, has also been released by Wild Boo Press. First Degree Murder did so well that you decided that people should learn more about this case. And of course, it really does deserve to have two books, because it's that involved a story. And I'm happy that you came on tonight and talked about the second part of this. And we did have to do a recap somewhat of what had happened and who Elsie Underwood was and why these murders occurred in the first place. I want to thank you so much for talking about your new book, Raging On. For those that might want to take a look at this work, can you tell us more where they might find this book, and if you have a website, Facebook, Instagram, any of those kinds of things for contact?
Sure. They can obtain the book at a number of outlets. Certainly Amazon has First Degree Rage and Raging On. They are available in Kindle, Audible, as well as paperback. And my publisher's website, I have a webpage there as well. That's wildbluepress.com. And there's more information. There's blog and some extra information there on that website. And it's also available at walmart.com and some other book outlets as well. First Degree Rage did come out last April of 2020, and Raging On was just released in July.
Thank you very much, Paula May, for coming on and talking about Raging On. It's been an absolute pleasure. You have a great evening, and hope to talk to you again soon. You have a great night.
Thank you for having me. You too.
Good night.
Good night.